Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show. While debates continue over logging in the West, real progress is being made in the East. We'll look at a coalition of interests backing a protection plan for the Great Northern Forest. Then we'll examine a law that aims to benefit forest health. Critics say it's a hoax. We'll look at a new movement bringing old-style urban development to the suburbs, and we'll set a forest ablaze in the pine bush. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Few issues are as contentious as timber in the West. But in the East, a combination of diverse interests is backing an agreement that may provide the sort of forest protection hard to find elsewhere. Hanging over the country like a toupee on the side of its head is the Great Northern Forest. It's comprised of 26 million acres of trees that stretch from the rocky coast of Maine through New Hampshire and Vermont to the Adirondacks and Lake Ontario in New York. Hardwoods, maple, birch, and beech are mixed with boreal forests of spruce and balsam, 7,000 lakes and 2.5 million acres of wetlands, and 250 species of vertebrate wildlife are all found in the Great Northern Forest. 1 million people live there, and many of the hemisphere's migrant songbirds nest there as well. Unlike the West, where most of the forest land is in federal ownership, 84% of the Great Northern Forest is privately owned, and much of that is owned by a handful of pulp and paper companies. A Northern Forest Lands Council comprised of environmentalists, timber company executives, state and local government representatives has worked for 4 years to develop strategies to protect the forests and local economies. They called for a federal umbrella which would stimulate state and local efforts to do everything from land use control to changing tax policy. Patrick Leahy, the United States Senator from Vermont, is author of the Northern Forest Stewardship Act, which would put a process in place to protect the forest and the communities within it. He expects to get it through the Congress this year.
My legislation would bring together everything from conservation and rural development, research and wood product manufacturing, marketing and sound forestry practices, and bring that together. The alternative is this. We could have a forest which could just be chopped up for development. A lot of its uses could be lost, or we could have something that in the next century will still be a productive forest, will still allow people to make a living out of the forest, but will also be there to enjoy, just as my generation does and my father's generation did before me and so many others have.
A recurring issue in all regional land use management is the role of the federal government. The feds are not popular with the locals, but federal resources are essential. David Miller, Northeast Regional Vice President of the National Audubon Society, thinks Leahy's legislation has got it about right.
And it balances these needs by creating mechanisms to protect outstanding natural resource areas, what we like to call wildlands, helping define sustainable forestry so private land ownership and resource use continues to go on in harmony with the forest ecosystem, and providing community assistance and grant programs to local communities and their economies. We like to coin this as the three legs of our public policy stool.
One of the big questions is whether individual states can come up with forest practices that contribute to the goals of the combined effort. Separate from the Lands Council, one group of citizens in Maine is putting an initiative on the ballot for a statewide referendum to ban clear-cutting. On this issue, the cooperation between citizens and industry is not apparent. Steve Blackmer is chairman of the Northern Forest Alliance, which includes the 28 environmental groups from all four states that are working together. He sees a real fight ahead.
The Northern Forest Lands Council initially did not deal with forest practices at all, and only after extensive public outcry at listening sessions 2 years ago in the spring of 94, did the council even begin to address forest practices. So a number of citizens really took that issue into their own hands out of deep frustration at the inability of the public sector to respond to those concerns. The referendum is going to be a fascinating example of how strongly citizens do feel. I fear it will be a very divisive battle between the environmental community or portions of the environmental community and portions of the forest industry on the ballot in November.
Everyone who has been involved in the Great Northern Forest effort says that the communication and cooperation between all the interest groups has made it go. Bob Stegeman, a regional manager for the International Paper Company, an industry landowner in the Northern Forest, is very supportive of the effort and has been an active participant.
I think that the Northern Forest Land Council effort demonstrated that through discussion and collaboration with other interest groups that something can be done to move forward. And it may be slow progress, I think it's progress nonetheless.
Protecting an ecosystem and an economy as large as the Great Northern Forest spread over four states is not something we have been able to do before. But in the Northeast, the effort seems to be off to a solid start. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. While industry and environmentalists are struggling to preserve the Great Northern Forest in the East, a firestorm rages over publicly owned western forests. Last fall, an amendment to the federal budget bill opened a lot of previously protected forests to logging. More recently, U.S. Senator Larry Craig from Idaho is moving legislation which he calls the Federal Lands Forest Health Protection and Restoration Act. The bill permits expedited cutting of trees on public lands if they're in forest health emergency areas, or areas that have been subject to fire and insect infestation. Doug Crandall is the Vice President of Public Forestry with the American Forest and Paper Association and cites reasons why the legislation is necessary to keep our forests healthy.
The first reason, and even though it sounds self-serving to us in the timber business, is that we do have serious forest health problems, especially in the inland west. And anybody that has spent any time there knows this. Very few people don't understand the fuel levels that we have. We have way too many dead and dying trees, way beyond anything that was ever there naturally. And although, again, it may seem self-serving, the only way you can deal with that is either, one, wait for it to burn, and two, remove some of the material.
Environmentalists assert that there is no forest health crisis, and that the Craig bill is just another effort to increase logging. Roger Schlickhuysen is the president and CEO of the Defenders of Wildlife, a national environmental organization.
The whole charge that there's a forest health crisis out there is a hoax perpetrated by the timber industry in order to expand cutting without the environmental safeguards. Well, what we find is that they're not really looking at the important things they have to look at to determine forest health. To determine forest health, what you want to do is look at the forest ecosystem health. What you want is a positive health situation for the forest ecosystem that will provide for sustainable use of those forests, sustainable cutting over a long period of time. The timber industry's view is not to look at the ecosystem's health, but rather to look at health from a perspective of how they can most quickly cut the biggest trees and increase short-term timber production. And that's exactly contrary to what forest ecosystem health is all about in the long term.
The need to look at ecosystem health as a totality is emphasized in another report just released by the Wilderness Society. Forest ecologist Greg Applett, one of the authors, is also skeptical about forest health claims.
Well, the industry claims that there are too many trees out there and that the only way to fix the forest is to remove some of them. We think that while there are certainly cases where 100 years of inappropriate logging, grazing, and fire suppression have created conditions that are novel and unhealthy, those conditions need to be addressed through a long-term commitment of the reintroduction of fire and the application of scientifically derived management prescriptions.
It's now up to the Congress to determine whether there's a difference between a healthy forest and a healthy ecosystem. I'm Peter Burley, and you're listening to The Environment Show. Still ahead, a new movement in housing developments brings elements of the city to the suburbs. We'll speak with a researcher who studies how the West African rainforest regenerates. And our Earth calendar sets a forest on fire in New York. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Most environmentalists will tell you that suburban development is harmful. It squanders land, it keeps us in our cars, and detaches people from their community. But it goes on unabated. Many urban areas suffer from neglect, and almost all new homes are built in the suburbs. A new movement has developed which challenges traditional suburban development. Karen Kelly takes a look at new urbanism to see just how green it is.
Today, most houses, offices, and stores are built away from each other. Houses are built in housing projects, stores are built in malls, and offices are built in office parks. To get from one to another, you often must drive a car. But a new movement in architecture called New Urbanism is trying to change that. It uses the classic American town, complete with alleyways, corner stores, and compact mixed-use development as a model. Robert Drips is a professor of architecture at the University of Virginia. He says current development patterns work against the environment, and new urbanism brings it back to the human scale.
What it is an attempt to refute or reject the kind of experiments in settlement patterns that have been with us a good portion of this century, coming out of some of the social agendas and technical agendas of modern architecture.
In other words, new urbanism is in some ways a return to old urbanism. There are now about a half dozen new urbanism developments planned across the country, and more are expected. One such development is Haymount in Virginia. John Clark is the developer. He says his goal is to create a town where people are connected to their community and environment.
Hey, Matt, it's about recreating community. It's about real estate development being about a sense of place, about the ability of a family to meet their needs within the confines of the community rather than commuting willy-nilly across the landscape without any rhyme or reason.
While new urbanism developments are typically small, the Disney Corporation is building a city called Celebration, which will eventually boast 20,000 residents. The design is based on many new urbanism concepts. While new urbanism may have many environmental benefits, from preserving land to reducing automobile use, Disney is betting that it will have economic benefits as well. Don Kaloran is the general manager of the Celebration Company. He says Celebration will preserve almost as much land as it develops, and that makes for good business.
It is going to be a profitable venture. Whether or not new urbanism is more profitable is a question really that will be determined as we look back after a few years. It is more expensive to do some of the things that we're doing here. The addition of alleys, addition of miles of trails, developing out parks. It is a more expensive development process. Whether that can be borne out by increased lot prices is yet to be seen and proven. We believe that it will be. We've certainly had a great deal of demand for our homes.
But new urbanism has its share of problems. All new urbanism developments have been constructed in suburban areas. Many environmentalists say we should focus on our existing cities and towns before developing new ones. Developers say cities often have restrictive zoning and building laws. For instance, mixing houses with offices and stores, like in Haymount, is illegal in many cities.
Small towns have an obligation to compete with the suburban office parks, to find ways in their community to accommodate businesses that typically occupy the 10,000 foot floor plate on three floors with the sea of parking around it, the fiber optic downtown for communication, ease of housing, affordability of housing, ease of commuting for the people that are involved in the business, and a willingness on the part of the community to embrace business as a partner and make it a two-way street, not an adversarial relationship.
Clark and others point out that new urbanism is still a recent phenomenon and will grow and change with time. Professor Robert Drips says new urbanism is a way to reunite Americans with our urban landscape. Drips says Americans are relearning how to develop and live in urban spaces. He says new urbanism is one step towards creating communities which will retain their value instead of being abandoned in favor of a new development which reaches further into our green spaces. For the Environment Show, I'm Karen Kelly.
You're listening to the Environment Show. We'd like to hear from you. Write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. As the world's rainforests are cut down, some scientists have begun researching how to bring them back. Thomas Smith is a biology professor at San Francisco State University and leads a research project in the rainforests of Cameroon in West Africa. He spoke with Environment Show producer Thomas Lally and says that 10% of Cameroon's rainforests have been lost in just the last decade.
The work that that we've been focusing on is trying to understand how ecological processes come together to maintain and generate biodiversity. This specifically led to our interest in the role of these large forest hornbills in dispersing seeds of major rainforest trees. And as forests become logged and otherwise degenerated by human activity, these dispersers of forest trees become more and more important.
Describe what the rainforest looks like in this part of the world. What sort of environment are you dealing with?
Well, I think if you had to sum up a rainforest in a single word, it would be green, very, very green. You're dwarfed by these gigantic trees, many of them over 150 feet tall, and obviously very humid, the sounds are the most, the sounds and the smells, I think, are probably the most inspiring. The sounds of the forest, everything from crickets to tree frogs to large birds, and the smells of flowers pollinating and so on. It's really it's something that one has to experience for themselves, but one that would be very tragic to lose.
I understand you worked with the native people in Cameroon. What sort of role did they play in the research?
Yes, the Baka are really, this work wouldn't be possible without their assistance. The Baka people, of course, are indigenous people to the rainforest, and we use them as guides, and so much of our information comes from their knowledge of the forest. Many of them will know as many as 200 different native names for the trees, for example. They know virtually every sound in the forest and are essential. In fact, you can easily get yourself into trouble if you're out there by yourself and don't understand if you're unable to differentiate different sounds.
Thomas Smith is a biology professor at San Francisco State University. He leads a research team in the West African nation of Cameroon. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Whether we like it or not, fire plays a major role in many ecosystems. The policy has been to put forest fires out as soon as possible, but in the long run, suppressing fire can be disastrous for both humans and the environment. Fire season begins in spring and intensifies as the weather gets hotter and drier. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally recently visited one of the few places controlled burns are conducted in urban areas and has this report.
In the pine bush in Albany, New York, a group of ecologists and fire managers gather to set the forest on fire. 20 years ago, these people would probably have been put in jail for doing something like this, but today it's routine. Chris Hover is the ecologist for the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission. He says conditions are just right for a fire.
Well, today's we had some good drying over the past couple of days. It's been kind of wet, but we got good drying yesterday. The winds are a little light, but they're from the south. They have a southerly component, which is good for this area because we don't get winds with a southerly component too often this time of year in the spring. So this is a good day for this unit.
Though it may sound odd, the pine bush, like many forests, need to burn periodically to remain healthy. The pine bush is not like most forests around here in the Northeast. It was created about 20,000 years ago when the glaciers retreated and left essentially a big pile of sand. Over time, plants and animals adapted to the conditions, which includes the occasional fire. After testing the equipment, fire managers spread out through the woods, and very meticulously, fires are set. The burn area is ringed with fire breaks, which are raked ahead of time. Piece by piece, the forest is burned. The strategy is to allow the fire to move towards the inside of the burn area, keeping the most intense flames well away from the rest of the forest. But fire is only one worry. The pine bush is in an urban area. There are housing developments, strip malls, and major highways all around. And Hover says keeping the smoke in check is a major priority. But people don't mind the burns much around here. They know that without the burns, dead trees and leaves can build up, setting the stage for a catastrophic fire.
We burned this unit 2 years ago, and like I said, when you burn, you reduce fuels. You have that fuel reduction. In Yellowstone and a lot of the wildfires out west, the problems they're having out west is they're getting these huge increases of fuels because natural wildfires can't occur anymore. Usually when they can occur, they're put out almost immediately. And you don't have that natural process where fire reduces those fuels and keeps them to a lower level. So when you do have a wildfire, it's just going to be that much more intense and that much harder to control.
Before the fires are set, there is an intense process of public notification and education. Today, things are going well. There's only a trace of smoke in the surrounding neighborhoods, and traffic is moving smoothly. Deborah Adler is with the Nature Conservancy, one of the groups coordinating the burn. She says without periodic burns, the pine bush would be unhealthy.
Well, you can save the land that the Albany pine bush is on, but without fire, the pine barrens themselves will eventually disappear. It's important for those ecological systems that are accustomed to fire to be able to experience that fire regularly. So some things that seem out of control and frightening are in fact part of the natural cycle and are important to the environment really worldwide.
After about a half hour, the fires have burned the perimeter and begin working their way towards the middle. When a patch of saplings burn, the flames reach 10 to 15 feet high. The heat is intense, and fire managers cover their faces with protective gear. When the fire passes, the earth is blackened and a few logs remain on fire. Joel Hecht is the steward of the Pine Bush Preserve. He says the difference between the freshly burned area and a neighboring patch of forest is dramatic.
What we're doing over there is knocking out a lot of the non-natives, and fire over here would knock that out, you know. And eventually you'd end up with a much more open look like we have, which is more typical pine bush. Pine bush should be more open. It shouldn't be dense like this.
So you look at this here, and this looks...
This needs lots of help. This area needs a lot of work. But one good intense fire in there will knock back a lot of that understory, you see, and open it right up.
Although there are only a few areas in the world where you'll find pine barrens like Albany's pine bush, most ecosystems have evolved with fire. Controlled burns, like this one, is one way to return a natural process to an otherwise urbanized land. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 330. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, and Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.